Into business. Oh, hello. Sorry, I'll do that again, shall I? Morning. I'm Stu Fox from Microsoft New Zealand. I'm a technical specialist for the data center business. So I work System Center, Hyper-V, Windows. Big thanks for inviting me over to Australia to speak to you guys. I was actually last speaking at TechEd Australia about Hyper-V in Windows Server 2008. So there's quite a bit of change. How many of you guys are actually running Hyper-V in production? Oh, that's good. And lots. That's fantastic. And how many of you have downloaded Server 2012, had a play with it during the beta and all that? Oh, good. Good. So what we're going to do today is go through part one of what's new. Now, I actually did this in New Zealand last week in an hour. I did two sessions. Basically, the two sessions I'm doing today, I did it in an hour in New Zealand. So is my mic failing? So, this morning we'll be talking part one. So we're going to talk about scale-up workloads. We're going to talk about storage. We're going to change microphones.
Good to go. Cool. We've switched to analog. We've gone old school again. Digital wasn't cutting it. So we're going to talk about scale-up workloads. We're going to talk about storage, talk a bit about clustering and resiliency, a bit about automation and management, and a bit about virtual machine migration. So those, I guess, are the key things for this morning. This afternoon, we'll be looking at networking, VM mobility, DR, and Linux. So I guess some marketing first. You know, the message is Microsoft's hybrid cloud is about, you know, having a single platform for managing, single platform for identity, single platform for development, a single platform for virtualization that is common across private and public clouds. So, you know, whether you're running internally on Hyper-V, externally on Windows Azure, You've got a single platform in the middle that is common to both of those things. So, and I promise this will be the last marketing slide. So, building your own cloud just got a lot easier than Windows Server 2012. Yeah, great. So, what does that mean? What I've tried to do during this throughout this presentation is I've called out a few of the key sessions during the week that are related to this. So, this one is probably, if you go to this session and no others and spend the rest of the time in the pub, then you probably will have gained a lot from TechEd. This is probably the best session you'll see all week on Hyper-V. This is Ben Armstrong doing a deep dive into what we did around the new performance, new scale and stuff. It's a fantastic session. I saw it last week. Awesome. Well worth a look. And I think it was our second rated session overall at TechEd New Zealand, so it is worth a look. So, what did you guys tell us about scaling up in Hyper-V? First thing, yeah, we need to scale. That virtual processor limit, it's not enough. We need to scale bigger. We want to virtualize everything and anything. But one of the things that we heard loud and clear was, hey, when you're building features, don't build features that mean we have to turn off things like live migration. You know, if you're going to build a feature, make sure it is enabled for live migration. Make sure that we can move machines around, because it is key to what we do, you know, in terms of mobility, in terms of high availability, that kind of stuff. Make sure it just works. Also, when we scale up, make sure we scale up well. Make sure we're not, you know, make sure we can, you know, don't just go, oh, you can do X number of virtual processes, but it's only really good up to 8 or whatever, you know. So make sure that when we do scale, we scale well. And let's try and virtualize everything we can. Let's try and put no boundaries on this at all, or as few boundaries as we can. So what did we do? Well, first thing is we've introduced massive scale in the box. So we've gone up to, in terms of the physical host itself, up to 320 logical processors, up to 4 terabytes of physical memory in the host. So you can build some pretty decent sized boxes. I make a joke that we could run New Zealand on like a couple of boxes that size. So, you know,
easy.
Yeah, easy. Yeah. Maybe, well, two, one's really for failover. You know. we can build massive clusters as well. So clusters of 64 nodes and up to 8,000 VMs. So that 8,000 VMs was a change we made just as we released. So it was 4,000 all the way through release candidate. So you can build these giant clusters. So scale up is not a problem. In terms of virtual processors, 64 virtual processors are the maximum in it. And that is for Windows Server 2008 R2 and Windows Server 2008 and Windows Server 2012 and Linux as well. It won't be supported for things like Windows Server 2003, and Ben will go into some of the details about why that is so. In terms of VMs, memory, up to 1 terabyte of virtual memory in a VM. Again, massive scalability. We've removed the limits, the software limits around live migration and storage live migration. So what we're saying is there's no software limit in place to stop you doing, you know, 100 simultaneous live migrations. Whether you've got hardware limits in place that prevent that, well, that's another story. But we don't want to limit you in software. So if you want to try and do 100 live migrations at a time, try. But, you know, we suggest finding something with that. I'm going to have to stand really, really still, aren't I? The other thing is we had this virtual processor, logical processor commit ratio that we would use, and we had it, you know, 8 to 1 for servers and 12 to 1 for client operating systems. We've basically removed that virtual processor, logical processor ratio. That was basically a support limit. It wasn't actually a physical limit at all, but it was a support limit. We've removed that support limit, so basically you can ring up and say, hey, I've overcommitted my processors, you know, 100 to 1. We might tell you that's a stupid thing to do, but we're not going to block you or block, you know, and support may say, well, maybe you might try cutting that back a bit, you know, but it's not a, there's, again, there's not a limit in that. We're not going to put a support limit around that. So because Microsoft don't have stacks and stacks of money, they don't give me any hardware to play with, so I can't show you any of this stuff. So here's a Windows 2008 R2 machine running 32 virtual processors. There's a Linux machine running 32 virtual processors, and there's a Windows Server 2012 machine running 64 virtual processors. And you can see why we had to rewrite Task Manager there. 64 virtual processors don't really fit very well onto the screen. So massive scalability. And if there are any OEMs in the room and they want to lend me some of this to play with, you know, StuFox@Microsoft.com, I'll happily take it. So one of the other things that we just talked about was, hey, we want to be able to scale well, and so we'll go into this in a bit more detail, but one of the things we've done is around NUMA. So as we start to scale up and run these giant machines, non-uniform memory access starts to become an issue. So in the physical world, you know, we end up with, as we get more and more processors, they get broken up into what we call NUMA nodes, and each NUMA node has its own set of processors and memory, and memory memory in a NUMA node, it shares it with the processors in that NUMA node. And so what we try and do when we're scheduling is we try and allocate memory to the processor in the same NUMA node. And we try and minimize any crossing of NUMA nodes from processor to memory. So you know, here's an example which is optimal, right? So we've got a whole bunch of memory in the machine, but it's each, and when we're accessing memory from a processor, we're accessing memory in the same NUMA node. We're not going across any of those NUMA boundaries. So that's fast and won't have any performance impact. So what will happen in a suboptimal configuration is, you know, we might have NUMA nodes that don't have any memory at all, or and what they have to do basically is they have to reach out to other NUMA nodes and use memory in those nodes. And what that does is it actually slows it down significantly, and Ben will talk a little bit more about this as well. And so, you know, what we get there is basically a performance hit. And what we've done in Hyper-V and Windows Server 2012 is we've had to think about that, because we traditionally just said, you know, we didn't really have a real problem with that because we had up to four virtual processors, and we had a little checkbox which was something like, you know, allow NUMA node spanning or something, and that was all we really had to do. And Hyper-V and Windows Server 2012, we had to think about that a bit more, because as we scale, obviously we need to try and keep the guest memory allocation associated with the same NUMA node that the CPUs are being scheduled on. So we've had to do a bit of work around that. The good news is that actually you don't really have to do anything, but what we do is we present up the physical NUMA node topology up into the guest. So the guest is aware of what's happening at the hardware underneath and goes, okay, cool, I need to schedule my processors in memory in this way. You've got a NUMA-aware workload, it will schedule appropriately and it'll do things appropriately. We give the ability to muck around with it, but we don't really recommend that you do. And we also give the ability to reset it back to default. So if you do muck around with it and find that performance starts to degrade, well, you can reset and go back to what the default is. So that's scale up. So next, storage. So he told us a bunch of things about storage. One was, hey, we're paying for these fancy SANs that are really, really expensive and really, really capable. What we do is basically use them as dumb disk arrays, pretty much. How about we leverage some of the smarts in the arrays? But also, how about we give our VMs access to some of those SANs as well? So instead of having to map it all through Hyper-V, how about we give them access? And if we've got workloads that don't require a SAN, how about you help us reduce the cost of that storage as well? And then also, we want to run bigger volumes in terms of our virtual disk. You know, you can scale massively on physical disk, but your virtual disk limit is just under 2 terabytes. So we want to scale bigger than that. So what do we do? So again, another session to go and see, Ben's session on live migration, storage live migration. The first thing is a few cool things. My probably one of the biggest things that when I talk to customers that over the last few years around Hyper-V was you need live storage migration. You need live storage migration. We've operationalized it in other platforms. You need live storage migration. So, hooray, we've got live storage migration. Like I said before, we don't put a limiter in the number of live storage migrations you do, but you know, you will need to plan for storage and I/O and that kind of thing. We've also introduced virtual fiber. So virtual fiber channel allows us to present HBAs into, or virtual HBAs into a virtual machine. In that virtual machine, those virtual fiber channel cards can then be assigned their own storage on the SAN, and that storage can be independent from the Hyper-V host completely. So, you know, so the host will never see it, as opposed to the old pass-through disks where the Hyper-V host had to actually be in the zone for that particular bit of storage. For virtual fiber channel, the storage is presented directly to the VM and the host never sees it. So that allows us to do things like build guest clusters on fiber channel storage. We've also introduced support for file-based storage. So instead of using, you know, our SAN or local attached storage, we can also use file-based storage on a Windows Server 2012 file share. So with the SMB3 protocol, we've made a massive amount of improvements, and I think there's a deep dive into SMB3 sometime this week, which is good to go to and figure out some of the things we have done around SMB3 to make it performant and scalable and also very, very resilient. But what it means is, you know, you can now run your Hyper-V hosts with shared storage, with Windows Server file servers acting as the shared storage. And you're probably going, well, that doesn't sound like a very good idea, because when you fail over a cluster and do all that kind of stuff, there's a massive delay, and I wouldn't want that to happen when I'm running Hyper-V Hyper-V VMs, because you know that's a couple of minutes while things down. Go and see the SMB3 session, because I'll go into that and you'll understand why that's not a problem anymore. We've also introduced new VHDX format, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, which is a new virtual hard disk format. Also, a couple of online meta operations, so live merge of snapshots, that's a big hooray. You know, like, why should I have to shut my machine down to merge a snapshot? So that's, again, just for me, that's fantastic news. Also, native 4K disk support. So no longer do we have to run in 512E mode. If you're running 4K disks, we'll support it natively in the platform, and we will align properly across 4K disks as well. So when we had a bit of a problem with dynamic disks growing on 4K disks. They would basically get out of alignment and performance would start to suffer a bit. And so with the improvements we made around native 4K disk alignment, those problems have gone, and we get basically excellent performance on 4K disks as well. A new thing we've introduced is this thing called offloaded data transfer, ODX. And what this is basically, it's a standard we've been working on with Dell and NetApp, and the other vendors are actually implementing it in their arrays as well. What this allows us to do is offload storage operations to a SAN, and we'll talk about this in a bit more in a second. And the last thing is unmapped support. So where you've got unmapped support in your array, we can reclaim unused blocks on the disk, and that flows right through the storage stack. And I think I added a slide on this last night, but if I don't, we're going to see that in a demo anyway, so don't worry too much. So VHDX, the new format for virtual hard disk, it is the new default as well. So if you go through the wizard to create a virtual hard disk and go next, finish, it will create you a VHDX, not a VHD. There's a couple of great things about it. The first thing is that it scales massively, so it's up to 64 terabytes in size for a virtual hard disk. And I don't think Ben's repeating his Hyper-V storage session this week, but last week Ben's guidance was don't use pass-through disks for performance. Use virtual hard disks for performance because actually they perform almost as well as native. So when you're using don't think about virtual hard disks pass-through disks anymore, especially when it's 64 terabytes. You've got a lot of options there, and if you need to grow bigger, go virtual fiber channel. One of the other things is there's an internal metadata log inside of VHDX now, and what that allows us to do is actually be a bit more resilient around things like power failure. So if we lose power during a metadata operation, so we're extending a dynamic disk, we will actually be a whole lot more resilient to that failure as opposed to the VHD format. Obviously, our alignment to 4K disk, much better. Better performance, so we use larger block sizes in VHDX, so our performance gets much better. And we can also embed custom metadata inside of VHDX, so you can do things like embed data about what this template actually had, what OS it is, what patch level it's at, those kinds of things. You can actually embed your own custom metadata so inside the VHDX format, so when you pick it up, you can look at that metadata and go, okay, cool, this is, whatever it is, rather than having some random VHD called, random VHDX on disk and having no idea what it is. So because Ben isn't doing his storage session, I nicked a couple of his slides. So in terms of performance, pass-through is blue. Our fixed performance in purple on VHD, our performance in VHD on purple, performance in VHDX in red. So you can see for the fixed scenario, we're slightly better than VHD because we did a lot of work around making sure that VHD was optimized for those fixed size scenarios. We've got a 10% improvement in IOPS in terms of dynamic disks and a 10% improvement in differencing disks. So that's for 32K random writes, and for 1 meg sequentials, basically 25% improvement as well. So VHDX is more performant, VHDX can grow bigger, VHDX is more resilient. So it is the default, new default, so use it. If you want to convert from VHD to VHDX, you can do that in the console, that will let you do that. And if you want to convert back from VHDX to VHD, you can, as long as the disk is shorter, as long as isn't bigger than 2 terabytes or just short of 2 terabytes. But I can't really see many scenarios where you would want to go back. So offloaded data transfer. So offloaded data transfer is this ability to offload storage operations to a SAN. And what this lets us do is and so our SAN needs to support ODX. And like I said, this is a standard that we've built with Dell and NetApp, but all the other vendors are building the support in. And so there isn't really a list at the moment of who supports it, who doesn't, but it is worth talking to your vendors. I know NetApp are doing it in their 8.2 on tap release. EMC are doing it, I think, at some point. Dell are doing it in their 6.2 release, so for Equalogic. So, you know, most of the vendors are doing it pretty quickly or in the short term. So what it is basically, you know, when you think about a traditional Windows file copy between two servers, you know, if you think about what actually happens, you know, Windows basically reads the data off the storage stack, you know, off the SAN, fires it over the network, you know, it's using CPU and network resource to do that, fires it over the network to your remote host. That basically picks it up off the network, you, again using CPU and network I.O., drops it down the storage stack. In some cases, it's to the same storage. It drops it down the storage stack and writes it back to disk. And so there's all these moving parts, and fundamentally all the data is done is moved a whole bunch of ones and zeros to, you know, from point A on a disk to point B on the same, you know, on the same storage. So we've wasted a whole bunch of CPU, a whole bunch of network, and a whole bunch of storage I.O. to do that. So what offload data transfer is all about is basically being able to say, well, I want to move this data from here to here. Mr. SAN, give me a token that represents all that data. I'll chuck it over to the receiving host. It goes, cool, Mr. SAN, do that copy for me. And that SAN will take care of that copy and tell the host when it's done, basically. And so instead of Windows having to pick up every bit and move it around, the SAN does it all for you. Minimal CPU overhead, minimal, and no network overhead at all. And in fact, your storage I.O. Is only impacted at the SAN stage. It's not affected at the host. So that's what ODX is all about. It's around offloading storage transfer. And it's a platform feature, so it's not a Hyper-V specific feature. So if you've got if you've got Windows Server 2012 physical machines attached to ODX capable storage, they can leverage this as well. But there are scenarios specific to Hyper-V that we leverage with this. Fixed VHD and VHDX creation is a good one. So how many of you have ever created like a 100 terabyte or 100 gigabyte fixed virtual hard disk? And it takes a really long time?
Yeah, about 250, 300
gigs. Yeah, and it takes an exceptionally long time. Yeah, like it's something that because Windows has to go through and write zeros on every sector of the disk, zero 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 zero, and you know fundamentally it's not really doing much that adds value. So it's one of the scenarios, and I'll show you this in a sec, where we get a bunch of value. Dynamic VHD and VHDX expansion as well, same thing. We can offload that storage and have that happen real quickly. Snapshot merge, same thing. Offload. And live storage migration, we can offload that to storage, and that will do that much, much quicker for us. So, the example, a 10 gig disk on an average desktop. I'm not sure why we're creating Hyper-V VMs on an average desktop, but 3 minutes, and less than a second on an ODX capable array. So, and we'll have a look at this in a sec too. Oh, yes, and unmap support. So unmap support, unmap, if you're working in the SATA world, it's called TRIM. If you're working in the SCSI world, it's called unmap. Unmap is the T10 standard around how storage gets told about unused space and can reclaim it. So what we've done is we've actually built support into the operating system and also into the virtual stack for supporting unmap. And so what it allows us to do is in the VHDX format, it allows us to reclaim physical disk space that is unused and basically reuse it or reclaim it back to hardware. And so that works all the way from a VM running on a VHDX all the way down to the storage itself. So you can actually get, even if you're just working inside a VM, that storage reclamation will happen all the way right down through the parent operating system, right down to the SAN. So it is supported only on VHDX and pass-through disks. And it is only supported on disks that are attached to the virtual SCSI or virtual fiber channel interface because it is a SCSI protocol. It won't work on a boot VHDX or a boot VHD. So with that, time to stop rabbiting on and show you something. So first thing, let's show you ODX and what the impact is. So this is actually Windows Server 2008 R2. And I'm going to create a new virtual hard disk file. I create a fixed size virtual hard disk, and I'm going to call it that. That'll be fine. And I'm just going to create 10 gig. And we'll see what happens. So that should probably start doing something. Cool. There we go. While we're waiting for that to happen, let's have a look at this one here. So this is a Windows Server 2012 box connected to Equalogic storage. And so if I go virtual hard disk, let's create a VHDX, why not? We'll fix size again. Yep, that's fine. And we'll create 10 gig. And we'll go finish and wait for it to oh, it's done. So that's our ODX, and I'll flick back to here. Still waiting. So look, so that's kind of the benefit of ODX. You know, like the SAN was able to, like that. This guy's still mucking around. So that's one of the things that ODX can do for us. Just kill that. So the other one was unmap. So let's have a quick look at unmap support as well. So I've got a PowerShell script which I meant to execute. So, got a simple PowerShell script, which is basically just reading off the VHD size and VHDX size on disk. Oops, that was a good reset. Oh, not used to using this touchpad. Right, go. So I'll just pop that over there. Just keep an eye on that. So that's just telling us how big the virtual hard disk. And I've got two VMs. So I've got one, which is attached to. I've got a VHD attached to the SCSI controller, just for comparison, and one which I've got a VHDX attached to the SCSI controller. So we've got these two guys here, and what we will do is I'm just going to copy a disk, a copy of a file inside each of those VMs. So I'll just copy that 3 gig file, and I'll do the same thing over here. Waiting. And you can see that file's growing. It's growing, right? Yeah. So that file's growing, and there we go, there's our VHD growing. So that's what we expect to happen. And while we just wait for that to finish, there'll be a brief uncomfortable silence. Actually, if there are any questions about this stuff, quickly, we can probably take one. Cool. Well, we'll stick with the uncomfortable silence then.
With the ODX, is that going to come to like direct attached storage?
The question was, with ODX, is it going to come to direct attached storage? The answer is most likely no, because it leverages the smarts of the array to do the copy or to do the operations. So yeah, the answer is most likely no.
But even like with a dedicated hardware RAID card.
Even with a dedicated hardware RAID card, it would probably require a lot of smarts in there. So we've finished one of our copies. We're just going to, first thing is we'll go through and delete that. And actually, there's an interesting point right there. The VHDX file I started copying after the VHD file, but it's actually finished faster because it is a faster, you know, because we have a bunch of optimizations in there for VHDX. So again, you know, a great thing, a great reason to use VHDX. I'm just going to delete that file, and what I'm going to do is I'm actually just going to run a quick PowerShell command to optimize the volume. So I'll optimize the. So Windows does this every 5 minutes or so, which is great if you're just running it in production, which is terrible if you're doing a tech ed demo. So I'll just force it, and away we go. So that's done, and this one over here should be done as well. Yeah. Good. So again, same thing. I'll delete that, and I will do the same thing, retrim the volume. Nothing's happened, which is what I expect, so you know, don't panic, the demo's not failing yet. Just talking myself up, making myself feel confident. And so what I'm going to do is now I'm going to copy to the Y drive, which is a different volume on the same VHDX file. So that's my VHDX copy going. Check what's happening to the VHDX file size. Nothing. So what's happened is with that retrim process, we've actually gone back and inside the VHDX, we've reclaimed the space that was being used by that previous file. We've reclaimed it, and now we're able to reuse it again inside the VHDX without having to grow the VHDX any further. You'll see there now I'm copying that second file in the VHD. That VHD size is actually growing. So, and you will notice that the VHDX size is a little bit bigger. There's a little bit of overhead there. But that was the first bit of unmap. So we've actually been able to leverage unmap support inside the VHDX format itself. So this is passing through the storage stack all the way down to the array, but VHDX is able to leverage that. So that's the first bit. So that file's still just sitting there at 4 gig. And let's go back here. Right, so now we're back on our VHDX guy. And I will just, same thing. Delete that file, and do the same thing again that we did before. I'll re-optimize that drive. So that's Y, and away we go. So now we're re-optimizing the drive. Same thing as we expected. Nothing happens there, but we've basically told it to go and reclaim that space. Now what we're going to do is I'm going to shut down this VM. And so this will take a couple of secs while it figures it out. So it's going to shut down the VM, and when it turns off, watch what happens to the VHDX size. So it could all go horribly wrong. Oh, there you go. So 4 gig, 0.54 gig. So as the machine gets shut down, bang, all that space is reclaimed on the SAN as well. So that's the benefit of unmap. And in fact, if we were looking at the array itself, and if we'd thin provisioned on the array, we would actually see that the array itself, the volume itself on the array, had actually shrunk as well. So this passes all the way down the VHDX stack from the VM itself down to the parent partition, down to the physical storage. So it's passed all the way down the stack. So that's VHDX and unmap. ODX and unmap. In a few easy steps. Pretty cool. Any questions on that? Yes.
If you're using Windows 7 2012 as your central storage, does that support ODX as well?
If you're using Windows Server 2012 as your central storage, does it support ODX as well? Yeah, it does.
No,
Windows Server 2012 natively doesn't support ODX. No, sorry, yeah, okay. Yeah, no, it doesn't. It wouldn't support having that on DAS. It has to be, SAN or, SCSI attached storage with ODX support.
What's the overhead on the trim process?
What's the overhead on the trim process? The overhead, because it's all happening as a SCSI command as opposed to, so the overhead's actually happening at the array. There's no overhead in the OS itself. It depends on what happens at the array. So, and I don't really want to talk about the competition much. I just don't like doing it because I'll probably be wrong, but I know that in one of their releases they actually had to disable unmap. Because of two things, actually. They had a software bug, but there was also a bug in some of the hardware vendors' implementations that actually made performance worse in some scenarios. I'm not saying, it's a terrible product or anything, I'm just saying, they had a bug, but they also had a vendor implementation issue as well, which caused some performance problems. The storage performance can impact that stuff. So it's just something to, I guess, keep an eye on. The question is to reclaim the space. It had to be a shutdown and a restart. The honest answer is I don't know on that one. I suspect they'll both do the same thing because it happened at shut off. I suspect the answer is that they'll probably be the same. There's like shirts here, so one for you. Try not to hit your head. And there was a question over here somewhere. I'll do this one as well. There you go. Cool. So. in terms of storage, massive improvements. Massive improvements. And I hope you agree. And there's also been a bunch of performance stuff in behind the scenes as well in terms of being able to deliver more throughput. And again, Ben will go through some of the performance changes we've done around the storage stack. One of the things we demoed at TechEd North America and TechEd Europe this year was 1 million IOPS from a single VM, and that was about some of the back end changes in terms of that storage stack. So we're able to deliver massive amounts of throughput, and it's interesting. In this case, we were actually hitting PCI 2 bus Gen 2 bus limits as opposed to any hardware limits, and the Hyper-V performance team actually think they'll be able to get more out of this. And we're also hitting some storage limits as well. This is on, I think, about 40-odd SSDs. So we're able to deliver massive amounts of performance, and so we can scale easily to do this stuff. So, I'll try and avoid talking about the competition, but one of the things that is commonly thrown at Hyper-V is, you guys use an indirect driver model and you've got these drivers that are not optimized for virtualization and your architecture is slow. And I kind of took a look at that and went, it's not very slow, and if it was slow, well, it's kind of slow enough, the things about the indirect parent partition being a bottleneck, not true. The things about the driver model not being optimized for virtualization, not true. The things about having bottlenecks, kind of hard to find. When you're hitting hardware limits, it's kind of hard to find a bottleneck in the software. So one of the other bits of things we've done around storage is around securing data at rest. So what do we do around data that's stored on disk in data centers or wherever, in fact? So, I talk to a lot of customers who are running Hyper-V out in their branches, but they're going, well, we've got stuff stored in the branches, and I've had a scenario where someone drove a forklift through the side of one of their branches and nicked off with their server. Fortunately, they found it all sort of bent to pieces, and I think they used the forklift to get it out as well. They found that up the road a bit, but so what we've done is added support for encrypted cluster shared volumes as well, so we can now BitLocker our cluster shared volumes. So if you've got stuff that's in less than secure locations, or if you want to keep stuff in your data center secure, you've got some security requirements around encryption or whatever, or you're a hoster and you want to do this stuff, then cluster shared volume BitLocker encryption is a huge one. So we use what we call the cluster name object. We use that to unlock the cluster shared volumes. So it's low impact, and just there, great little nice to have. So next, clustering. So first thing, we kind of talked about this. VMs need access to fiber channel SANs, and we talked about that. What about apps that don't support clustering? What about taking advantage of that SAN stuff again? And also about scaling those virtual disks as well. So there's a bunch of availability enhancements. There's a couple of good sessions on this week. Nick Teaming Multichannel Solutions will go into some of the Nick Teaming stuff and also the SMB failover stuff. Continuous availability goes into some of the new roles inside Windows Server 2012 around making and the new features around making file shares continuously available as opposed to just highly available. So first thing, Windows Nick Teaming. Yay, it's part of the platform. I had a comment last week that the best thing about Windows NIC teaming is that I no longer have to look at the Broadcom teaming interface ever again. you've all seen it as well. It's horrible. So that's that's a great thing. It's built in native to the platform. There's up to 32 NICs in the team. Bandwidth aggregation, all that kind of stuff. It is just built into the platform. Continuous available file server. So this is providing highly available file services continuously available file services, I should say. So the difference between continuous availability and high availability, it drops and you get it back again in a minute. Continuous available means it drops and you don't notice. So continuous available file share, and they'll go into that in the continuous available session, but it is a huge thing. We've also made some improvements around CSV, cluster shared volumes. So in version 2, we actually support things like storage array replication and hardware snapshots and those kinds of things. We support those out of the box. In CSV1, we kind of had some issues in terms of the way the filter driver was done, that we had, you know, the storage vendors had to rewrite some of their stuff, and they kind of didn't really get around to it. So CSV2 makes it just basically native support. We can build guest clusters with fiber channel for high availability. So if you've got virtual fiber channel, you've got, you know, you can build a 64 node virtual cluster if you want. You know, with that same 64 node limit for a cluster, you can build a 64 node guest cluster if you want to. Concurrent live storage migrations. This was obviously a big ask, and actually inbox queuing of live migrations as well. So, you know, just even using the built-in tools, doing a move, if you've got a limit set at four live migrations and you go to move 10 at a time, it'll just do the first four and queue the other six for you. So the queuing stuff actually helps as well. So, and there's a bunch of improvements around failover clustering as well. So there are a couple of sessions on this week, one around cluster shared volumes and one around cluster aware updating, worth seeing as well. So we talked about the 64 nodes, 8,000 VMs thing, so the scale thing was there. Cluster-aware updating is actually, again, a platform feature, but we can leverage it, you know, Hyper-V leverages it. So cluster-aware updating is the ability to basically, you know, if you've got two nodes in your cluster, that's kind of easy to patch. You know, you can move stuff and patch and move it back and patch again. If you've got 64 nodes in a cluster, patching that thing's kind of a problem if you want to do it manually. And I've got, I don't know about you guys, but I've got stacks of customers who still use WSUS and still have some guy that come in the middle of the night and go, install, reboot, next. You know, and I've still got stacks of customers that do that. At 64 nodes, that's not sustainable. So cluster-aware updating is a tool that's built into the box, allows us to remediate a cluster using effectively a single, couple of single clicks. but you know, so it is a tool built into the box, and there is a whole session on this around how it works and how to use it. Cluster shared volumes 2, massive improvements. VM failover prioritization. Again, one of the big asks we had was, you know, how do I make sure that my high priority VMs come up first in a cluster failover event, and make sure that, you know, the low priority ones don't take all the capacity or whatever. Failover prioritization is built into the box as well. Anti-affinity VM rules. Again, another big ask was, how do I do these anti-affinity? How do I stop VMs being together, or how do I make sure they stay together? Again, you could do anti-affinity inside Server 2008 R2 by mucking around in the registry and doing some horrible stuff. Anti-affinity and affinity is built into the box as well. Cluster-wide task scheduling means that you can do things like, I want to schedule a task that runs on all nodes in a cluster at the same time, or I want to schedule a task that runs on somewhere in the cluster at some point. So we can do these cluster-wide task scheduling. I've talked about live migration queuing. SMB support, you know, so being able to run your cluster using SMB backend. Actually, the SMB storage for running a cluster against, you know, you can also run SQL Server 2012 clusters against SMB storage as well. So it's not just Hyper-V that leverages this. Hyper-V app monitoring is basically a solution where if you've got a VM running on a host, you can actually use events happening inside that VM to trigger failover events in cluster. So you could say, you know, a particular event happens in the event log, make that trigger a failover, or a particular you're monitoring something inside the guest itself, that will trigger an event happening down on the host. So that's what app monitoring is all about. So it's around making sure that, you know, it might not be a highly available app, it might be only a single guest, but we can still trigger off failover events and that kind of stuff from events happening inside that guest. And guest clustering via fiber channel. So how the fiber channel stuff works. With the virtual fiber channel stuff, you can assign up to 4 virtual HBAs per VM, and each of those HBAs has 2 sets of worldwide names assigned to them, and basically with those worldwide names, you basically zone them on your SAN the same way you'd zone any other physical host attached to that SAN. You zone it for that particular host. We use NPIV, so you've got to have NPIV capable hardware. So your HBAs have to be NPIV aware, and they have to have NPIV capable drivers as well. And it does work with live migration, so that, you know, that was one of the big things was, hey, you give me, don't just give me guest fiber channel and then tell me I can't run live migration with it. Make sure if you're going to give it to me, make sure it works across the live migration scenario. And we do some quite sneaky tricks with that to make sure that does work. one of the things we do is, that's why we have these two sets of worldwide names for each HBA, and we kind of use those in the failover process. It's pretty clever, but it does mean we can leverage live migration. So from the ground up, redundancy is built into the platform. So things like the Windows hardware error architecture, and this is kind of cool and it's kind of nerdy, but the Windows hardware error architecture stuff will actually detect things like if it detects a RAM fault, it will actually detect that and try and shut down any process that's using that bit of RAM and no others. So you might have a VM using that that's been allocated that bit of RAM. If it detects a fault in that bit of RAM, it will be able to shut that VM down and nothing else. That's quite nerdy, but it's pretty cool. Live migration, failover cluster, in I/O, we've got multipath, we've got multi-channel SMB, which you'll hear about later. NIC teaming, we've got Hyper-V app monitor, we've got guest clusters, we've got guest teaming of NICs, and we'll talk about Hyper-V replica and that in the session later on this afternoon. So, automation. Who here loves PowerShell? Oh, yeah. If you don't know PowerShell, you probably should learn it. This is the release of Windows Server 2012 where you need to learn it. It's basically key to the platform. There's some stuff you can only do in PowerShell in Hyper-V, but basically there is, I think we've gone from, I don't know, a couple of hundred PowerShell commandlets in Windows Server 2008 R2 to about 2,500 odd commandlets inside Server 2012. It is configurable from the ground up via PowerShell. It is awesome. We've also added some support for, I don't know if you've heard about being able to move from server core to full GUI installs of Windows Server 2012 without having to do a complete reinstall of the OS. You can basically turn the GUI on and off with a reboot, which is pretty handy as well. So let's have a quick look at some of the PowerShell stuff. VS to 5. So, one of the things we can do is just have a look at all the commandlets for VM stuff, and there's lots and lots of commandlets for virtual machines, so you can do all sorts of stuff with VMs. The easiest thing is, and I'm just going to do this, we can, create a new VM, and that should hopefully have turned up a machine called Techie Demo. There we go, Techie Demo. And I want to connect it to a virtual network. Easy. I want to give it 4 virtual processors. Done. I want to turn on dynamic memory and set a maximum. Done. And then I'll probably want to start that VM. I'm going to start VM. Techie Demo, and that should just power up, and away we go. So completely configurable with PowerShell. Didn't have to touch the UI at all. Some people love that. Some people are terrified of it. I'm a command line guy. I love cmd.exe. So this is kind of okay for me, but some people this terrifies. I think it's fantastic. And like I say, configurable pretty much from the ground up. If we switch back here.
If you create a VM from there,
yep.
What are the faults if you don't specify memory or
this? The question is, if you create a VM from there and you don't specify memory, what are the defaults? Actually, the first command that I use to create the VM, you actually have to specify the startup memory. And if you do nothing else, that will be static memory with that value. The other command I ran was to enable dynamic memory and turn up the maximum. But the default is to create it with static memory allocation using whatever the value is in that first new VM command. Here's something I use to configure up those hosts. Probably a little bit hard to read, but things like once I've got the OS on there, configuring the NIC teaming, setting the IP addresses, renaming the computer, joining a domain, installing Hyper-V, installing the tools, restarting it, creating new virtual switches, creating new you know, new default paths and things, enabling it for replication, enabling it for live migration, those kinds of things. And so I configured these boxes without actually touching the UI at all, which was fantastic. Because I had to build them really, really quickly, because I built them to RTM from RC just before TechEdNZ, so I had to build them super fast. So this made it just a whole lot easier to do. A couple of other things around management. Improved import-export process. Who hates Hyper-V's export-import process in Server 2000 RT? It should be every hand in the room. It sucks. The great news about the import-export process, in fact, you don't really have to do the export. You can pick up, you know, if you've rebuilt your host, you can actually just point at the existing config files on disk and say, import that VM for me. It will go, okay, cool. Where are the virtual hard disk moved to? That's fine. And it'll even say, you know, I've detected that it was attached to this virtual network. That doesn't exist on this host. Do you want to attach it to a different virtual network? That kind of stuff. So the import-export process is a whole lot easier to deal with. So huge kudos there. Resource metering is another thing, and I don't think anyone's going to talk about this week. So resource metering is the ability to measure a VM for chargeback purposes. So you can basically, you know, have it recording CPU utilization, memory utilization, disk utilization, network I/O, that kind of stuff. You can do that inside Hyper-V, and we talked about the Windows hardware error architecture. So let's just have a quick look at resource metering as well. Which I think is that one. Right, so resource metering lets us do things like, I've got metering just turned on this particular VM. And so what you can see there, you can see my average CPU utilization in megahertz, my average RAM in meg, how much my maximum was, what the minimum was, how much disk is assigned to it, and how much network traffic I've got associated with that as well. I can also be a little bit more granular and see things like, you know, where the network traffic is going. And in fact, you can put different port ACLs on these things, and you can actually track, you know, if you wanted to track traffic going to a particular destination or whatever, using network metering and see how much is going through, you can actually do that with network metering. And so this is implemented as port access control list inside Hyper-V, which we'll talk about in the session this afternoon. And so with this, you can do chargeback. You know, if you're a hoster, you can build, you know, accurate chargeback reports, that kind of stuff. If you're doing it internally, you can use it to do showback or whatever you want to do. So just a nice little thing that's built in there. This is a PowerShell only feature, so you don't see this in the UI at all. You'll only see it in PowerShell in this release. So, virtual machine migration. So how do we get from another platform to Hyper-V, whatever that happened to be? In fact, that says beta. It shouldn't say beta. I missed that one in my edit last night. So the virtual machine converter solution accelerator, which isn't beta, it's released now. It's about a 4-odd meg download that we use to convert VMware virtual machines to Hyper-V. And so, you know, if you want to do an evaluation or whatever, you want to do that stuff, you can do it with the converter. It converts VMs, it converts virtual disks, it converts the configuration from VMware to Hyper-V. It'll uninstall the VMware tools and stick the Hyper-V integration services in as well. There's a UI for it, as well as a script or command line interface for using it. And it is, so we'll support vSphere 4.1 and 5 virtual machines. We actually will support vSphere 4 virtual machines if they are being managed by vCenter 4.1 or 5. So, and don't ask me about vSphere 5.1. I know it became available like yesterday or something, so I don't know the answer to that, but I expect no one's actually got it running yet, so I expect that'll be coming or not far off. So we can convert to Server 2008 R2 SP1 and to Windows Server 2012 as well. So that's there. That's available for download. There's a couple of short links there if you want to use those. And we've also, there's a beta out of the virtual machine converter vCenter plugin. So there's actually a plugin for Virtual Center, and it will do the conversion for you as well. So that's pretty much it for this morning. So related content, everything in the virtualization track is worth seeing. If you want to come and see me again, if I haven't put you off coming and see me, then I'm presenting again this afternoon, I think at 3:30. And so I'm doing part two where we look at networking and we look at some of the virtual switch stuff we've done there. Go and see Ben's 400 level session. It is truly awesome. And I'll be at the speaker lounge 11 to 11:30 today and tomorrow. Thank you all, and cheers.
Yes. Currently,